Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Daniel Shea, your host for episode 118 of the podcast. Today I'll be talking with Nick Enfield, Professor of Linguistics at the University of Sydney for Language Research and the Sydney Initiative for Truth. His book, Language Versus Reality, Why Language is Good for Lawyers and Bad for Scientists, was published by MIT Press in 2022. The book is the winner of the Prose Award for Language and Linguistics. There is something truly noble about the pursuit of scientific knowledge, or if the word noble grates on your ears, then call it admirable what scientists attempt to achieve. The scientist tries to know. However, every attempt at knowledge is all but thwarted by the scientist's own equipment for learning and the scientist's own mode of inquiry. And I don't just mean the things like the lab equipment or the statistical analysis. Sure, that stuff can also be miscalibrated or misread or misapplied. In other words, mistakes can be made anywhere along the line from manufacture to employment. But that's things going wrong. The thwart that I'm talking about here happens when things go right. For instance, take a scientist's attempted description of some mechanism in the learning done by a machine. The researcher here needs to understand how the one set of input affects the learning outcome in this manner, but then why one particular manipulation of that same input set changes the learning outcome in that manner. Really, it's a researcher's approximation of the machine's processing method, because the machine is, for example, classifying road signs by one set of criteria, which criteria are in themselves objects worthy of study, but those criteria change after the manipulation of the input to different criteria for the classification. The researcher's question is how and why. And though this researcher will have to hand all manner of mathematical notation and also various readouts on numerous implementations of the machine model, still, if the researcher wants to understand the matter, then he or she must have recourse to the prime mode of inquiry and the prime piece of equipment given every scientist, regardless of field of study and regardless of problem being studied. I am, of course, talking about the language of writing. Science depends on language no less than does the culture of politics or the culture of business or the culture of our private lives. It may seem at times that scientists have sort of removed themselves and their questions from the sphere of language which any layperson would typically call normal. And so it is quite understandable that the impression arises that scientists, A, have control over the language they use, and that scientists, B, need less language than we laypersons do even just to get through our breakfasts. But this impression is false. If anything, then scientists need language even more than do many who pursue non-science work, because the communication of findings is the very hinge around which the door of science swings. Besides, the problems which scientists want to solve, like why a machine model should call a stop sign, These sorts of problems continue to remove the scientist, at every next question and trouble in the search, farther and farther from common sense thinking. It is for this reason that scientists develop the notation of their symbolic reasoning, and it is why they enhance the accuracy of their measuring instruments, because scientists need to think not so much harder than the rest of humanity, but certainly farther from the ways of thinking that we humans have inherited from our cultures and our pasts, and definitely farther from the evolutionary design of the cognitive resources available through the brain. And this brings me to another piece of evidence proving that scientists do in fact need language quite a lot. And that evidence is the great care and attention which the entire endeavor of science has, from the very start, given to the resources of the written language. In the Western scientific tradition, beginning in the late 16th century, early 17th century, another way of thinking about the world spread at a furious pace with, and because of, another way of writing about the world. For example, as Isaac Newton was writing his treatise on optics during the 1680s, he was not just discovering new properties of light, but he was redeploying as well resources of the written language in order to aid him in that effort of knowledge-making. You might say Newton used prisms, and he used the words prism and prismatic effect in order to think things about light till then unthought. Take this clause in that treatise. I quote, "Now those colors argue a diverging and separation of the heterogeneous rays from one another by means of their refraction." End quote. Or take Newton's use of such terms as emergence, whiteness, inequality. Instead of such more usual terms as emerge, white, unequal. The writing I'm putting here on display is really indistinguishable from the writing as practiced by any researcher in, to continue the previous example, machine learning today. And it's my point here that that shared written language demonstrates a characteristically scientist attempt to put the language, in these examples, of English, to work for the discovery of causes and phenomena and qualities in the world of brute reality. So by this understanding of the matter, Newton is not avoiding the nominal I, nor is he obfuscating the action of the sun's rays by such nominalizations as diverging, separation, or refraction. Newton's big noun emergence, for the direct verb emerge, or for that matter, why not just simply become, this is not a blaring instance of jargon or science speak. No, what we read here is just one more scientist, albeit a major one, and a trailblazer in this operation on the writing, but nonetheless, Newton is just one more scientist pushing the wording of his thought out to the limit of what is known about the properties of light. Scientists do this literally, every day, all day. I once heard a biologist I was working with, a man with a stellar publication record, and with the PI position in an innovating research group, this man said to me, "We spend our days in the lab looking for the right words." Well, for Newton, in his day, and for his study, emergence and colors, argue, were the right words. Newton needed to halt the process of light and motion. But how? I mean, light is motion, isn't it? So to halt it in order to describe it required that it moving be turned into the word emergence. And if Newton was to develop his reasoning about the mechanisms causing the diverging and separation of the ray of light, then he must, as he did, pack the stages of his thinking arrived at into units he could maneuver to places here and there in the flow of his discourse. Therefore, in the above passage, the closing words, "by means of their refraction," can then be tracked in the ensuing discourse as "this inequality," or "the refractivity." Newton wouldn't have gotten very far in this had he stuck with just concrete entity, visible action, circumstance of the two together. No, Newton needed, and he found and he used, an instrument apart from his lenses and lens rigging, in order to be able to comprehend the stages of instant light. And today's machine learning researcher needs no less if she is going to comprehend the stages of decision boundary formation in a model. Therefore, both scientists are actually reliant upon their hacks to the written word. And there I discover a nobility of purpose. I don't care, I'm calling it that now. It is noble to me because the effort just appears to be so at odds with the instrument and the means through which the effort is being made. But the scientists continue making the effort anyway, and though the work gets no easier, and though the attempt remains fraught with the limitations of human reason and perception, still the scientists try. And they try the main way they have, and have to try, by writing words. My guest today on the show has written a book which lucidly explains why language is to the scientist what language is. Nick Enfield's Language Versus Reality is excellent linguistic work on the problems of language. But in true scientific fashion, Nick also faces that problem to explore as well just how we humans can know what language is and so enable ourselves to use language at the height of its capacity and to the best of our abilities. Let's see then in today's discussion as well how the scientists among us might also use language to that effect and with that ability. So let's begin today's episode. Nick Enfield and Language Versus Reality. Hi, Nick. Welcome to Scholarly Communication.
Hi, thank you for having me.
In our interview today, I'd really like to, as the introduction sort of indicated, explore this subtitle of yours. You have a fantastic title, Language Versus Reality, but your subtitle really caught my attention, Why Language is Good for Lawyers and Bad for Scientists. And perhaps to just sort of kick us off there in that general direction, what would be some of the more general points that you would say that scientists who, as we know, need to publish to do their research could learn from your own findings so that they can actually do the reading that they need to do and the writing that they need to do to the benefit of the research itself?
Well, there's an interesting tension for any scientist, and that is that we have to be scientists and lawyers at the same time. I should clarify what the subtitle means. So in the book, I'm really talking about a general tension that language has, which is on the one hand, we want to use it to talk about reality, to capture experiences accurately, to convey ideas and clarify matters. That's the sort of what we want to call the kind of scientific function of language. It's representing truth in a sense. And then there's the lawyer function of language, which is to persuade people, to manipulate people, to get people to do or to think the things that we want them to do or think. And so for a professional scientist, you know, we're really sort of stuck in the middle of this because to be successful as a scientist, you know, on the one hand, you mean succeeding in disseminating concepts and ideas. On the other hand, you also mean succeeding in one's career and sort of, you know, getting attention and being cited and all the rest of it. So what I think is ideal is that we maintain a commitment to truth and clarity of thought and accuracy in our work, but at the same time use the tools of language to kind of get above the noise of publishing these days and use the sort of tools of language, the affordances of language to convince and help others to kind of pay attention to what we're doing. And that would be the kind of perfect balance.
Yeah, I mean, you make some very clear statements, well, throughout the book for sure, but in the conclusion there, talking about how just this point there, that reality, I'm quoting, reality must be our ultimate mooring. And you make a very good case in the book for a distinction between brute reality, which, to simplify, would just be the rocks, the trees, and the stars out there in the universe. Whereas there's, on the other hand, this social reality, which is where language is in many ways at home. It's where language excels. And I think you do right now also present this tension very, very clearly, this idea that the scientist indeed is looking out at brute reality and yet doing their work inside of this social reality. I mean, I don't think any scientist would not agree with your point in the conclusion that it is the brute reality that is the mooring, that is exactly their object of study. And yet they know that they need to turn around and, as some people even say it, sort of translate that into articles and writing and reading also of other people's work.
Yes, absolutely. So brute reality is fundamentally important to everyone, not just scientists. It's obviously important to many scientists because many scientists study brute reality, which is really the world of physical causation. Many scientists, of course, study culture and social reality as well. One thing that I like to point out about brute reality is that brute reality is what makes us die. It is, you know, the thing that really matters to everyone in the end, that if you stub your toe on a rock or if you walk into a glass door, you know, that's brute reality, right? It hits you in the face. And that's what makes us sick. That's what causes accidents. So everybody in the world is interested in brute reality because we don't want to be injured. We don't want to be ruined. We want to know how to stay healthy and all of that. But much of our life is really based in social reality as well. Now, that distinction is not my own. It's a well articulated distinction in philosophy and sociology. And I quote the philosopher John Searle on this distinction, and he's very clear on the difference between brute reality and social reality. And social reality is important because social reality comes about through agreement, through human collective decision to treat something as being true. Now, that's the kind of thing that can create systems of trust like property rights, value of money, these kinds of things, social statuses, you know, membership in clubs, all of that sort of thing. And in my view, it's also the basis of linguistic meaning. It's the basis of all conventions. And language is like a kind of currency in that sense. It's sort of like money in the sense that we can, you know, we agree on what these different words mean, and we then let them circulate. So the sort of puzzle for scientists is that the only way that you can create a community of knowledge is through the social reality that is, you know, what we use to coordinate, right? So language is really the ultimate social technology for coordination. And no matter who you are as a scientist, you need to use language to educate other scientists, teach your students, you know, communicate at conferences. But really, in terms of being at the coalface, it's about talking, you know, arguing about your ideas, testing your ideas with others. And you have no choice but to enter into the world of social reality to make that happen. And more practically, of course, you are part of a world of, you know, I mentioned money before. As a researcher, you depend on funding and you depend on having a job and this kind of thing. And all of that is also part of the world of social reality. So that's, in a way, when you mentioned the last chapter of the book, I'm pointing to some of those tensions. But I think that what I really like to emphasize is that there's a danger with social reality, and that is that it can get us away from brute reality. It can make us pay attention to things that are only true because we agree on them being true. But those things can never undo brute reality. You can never agree to make gravity go away. You can never just simply agree for people not to be sick. And so in the end, we are accountable to brute reality. And that's why I keep emphasizing that it essentially outranks social reality in some important sense.
Yeah, very much so. And yet we see the interesting interplay in science itself, the pursuit of science and communities of scientists, of this brute reality and social reality. I mean, the whole reason that these communities or disciplines exist is because of brute reality, for very many of the reasons that you've just said, and also the fact that that is their object of study, right? I mean, if there weren't stars, they wouldn't be astronomers, for example. But this point that you make right here, that there is a danger, or at least an effect or influence coming from language use, from the conventions inside of those communities of scientists, that needs at the very least to be made, you know, public for people to, I mean, your book is doing this work. It's helping us see what actually happens when language is being used. And that's one of those things that I really appreciate so greatly about the book. For instance, in chapter 10, as you were talking, I had to keep thinking of social glue, as you call the chapter, where this idea of a community forming and the agreement between the members of it, and even how big it is. You break down for us sort of a social group of somewhere in the vicinity of 150 people being, let's say, a sort of limit on what could be called a group that know each other and would use that common language with the same understandings and the same ability to coordinate. And this lines up really interestingly with the way that publishing and success in science occurs. It's usually 10% of the scientists who are really making the impacts in their fields. They're the highest cited. They're the most productive. And that leaves a huge group of people outside of that range. It's one of those discrepancies in the way that science works that I've explored with other guests here on the podcast, where you almost have the sense that there's, yeah, I mean, a club always sounds terrible because it makes you think of, you know, late 19th century England. That's not exactly the picture I have in mind, but there is a group who know each other and who are speaking about the research that they happen to have, even in their articles, in ways that people outside of that group, they can't coordinate quite in the same way around those objects, can they?
No, that's right. It's important, I think, to recognize that the kinds of social arrangements that you're describing are really based on networks. And you know, networks have all of these interesting properties that I think account for the inequalities, essentially, that you're describing. So, you know, network systems tend to, in network systems, these hubs tend to emerge, these kind of nodes that are preferentially attached. So that's where you get kind of in publication citation figures, for example, you get a small number of papers being cited many, many times, and then you get a very long tail. So sort of a power law type relationship. And in social circles, that's also what you get. And one of the reasons, I think, is because you pointed to this sort of Dunbar number of a limit of around 150 people who are kind of connected in a social situation where they can all know each other and kind of circulate their ideas. Once you get higher than that number, then it's hard to keep track of everybody. So it's no wonder then that, you know, large communities of scientists break up into smaller communities, and sometimes you get that breaking up of communities converging with that sort of the long tail at one end, breaking up in various smaller kinds of groups, so that some people will be famous in their own very small circle, you know, and then the circles get bigger and bigger, and there's only a certain number of people who can be, famous or successful or, you know, heavily influential in the larger community of scientists. And you know, it's many hundreds of thousands of people that we're talking about. So it's really quite hard to have an impact at that higher level.
I've mentioned now coordination. I think you've used the term as well. It's really one of those key ideas in the book. It's in fact the idea that you sort of kick off the intro and then the first chapter with. And I think it's probably worth that you just give listeners a sense of what it is, because you, in my own understanding, really make the case that, you know, communication through language use is much less about the transferal of information, which would be, I think, what most people's view of communication is, right? This piece of information gets over there. And it's so much more about this idea of social coordination. Could you perhaps give a bit of a background to that idea?
Sure. So, you know, I've been very much inspired by my previous mentor and professor, Steve Levinson, who became a collaborator. So he works in the field of, well, many fields actually, but I got to know his work through the field of what's called linguistic pragmatics. And that's really looking at how people socially interact through language, how they use language to converse, to interact, to engage in joint action. And in sort of getting into that literature, the pragmatic literature, I discovered the work of Thomas Schelling, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist and sociologist. And he looked at coordination problems in human life. And so there are many basic coordination problems for human beings. So, for example, he had many examples, but if we are on the telephone and the line gets broken, we want to call each other back and resume the call, but which person is going to do this? That's a coordination problem. Would I wait for you to call me, or will you wait for me to call you? We both want the problem to be solved. It's in our mutual interest, and we just need to figure out, you know, how without discussing it because of the lines being cut. I need to think. Well, okay, will you call me, or should I call you? And people will generally converge on a solution that they think the other would also choose. And that's in the phone call case, that's usually going to be the person who made the call. If the call gets cut off, that person will be the one to call back. So we look for these kind of ways to coordinate with each other without communicating. And sometimes, you know, language, of course, allows us to coordinate through pure communication. We can make an agreement. For example, you know, we're going to meet tomorrow for lunch. Where should we meet? So we could discuss it, but oftentimes people will seek coordination solutions by defaulting to agreements that we've made before, or by consulting our common ground with people. So when we know people well, we can usually coordinate quite well with them without even having to make agreements. Often that's because we've done things in a certain way before. So we would meet at the same restaurant at the same time, and that way we don't have to kind of negotiate an agreement every time. So coordination problems are very important. They help us solve things like, you know, which side of the road should we drive on, and you know, consequential things like that. Now, language itself, so, you know, in the book I talk about this coordination problem issue, and the real kind of point I want to emphasize there is that language itself is really a technology for social coordination. It's what we use to align with other people, and it's what's really sort of magical about it is that it is something we use to coordinate with people we've never met before. So if we assume that others know the language that we know, in this case we're speaking English, I can make a long list of assumptions about things that you already have signed up for. In a sense, you've signed up for all of these English words having all of these meanings, and that presents us with a great sort of list of solutions to coordination problems. So if I need you to pass me the salt, luckily I have a word, salt, and because you're an English speaker, I can assume you know that word. And so that's a very simple case of a coordination problem being sort of generically solved by the fact that we speak a language in common. So it's easy to think of a language as being, you know, an information transmitting machine. But I don't think, and of course it does transmit information, but my point in the book is that that is not its primary function. The primary function of language, the reason why we learn it, the reason why we use it, is to coordinate with other people. And that's really, you know, if you look at language in the wild, that's what we're doing with it. We are either influencing other people in tasks, or we're cooperating with other people in tasks, or we're building common sense making through narratives, through gossip. In all of these sort of functions, we are essentially coordinating with other people, either in a very immediate kind of cooperative joint action, or in a much more general sense about sort of building, investing in our social relations, talking to people in ways that kind of, you know, build or develop our relationships and so forth. So that's coordination. And to my mind, it's really one of the most powerful features of language, but it's strangely underappreciated. And you know, linguistics in general has focused much more on the information transmitting function of language.
Indeed. I mean, that's what caught my attention so much in your book. And also professionally, my listeners will know that I help scientists write. And that is also just sort of from my professional life, there's just way more evidence there for exactly what you're talking about. This widespread belief among scientists, most of all, I would say that they see their tasks as packaging information into words, this idea of writing it up and figuring out exactly how to say it, exactly and precisely how to say it, and not noticing all the while all the math that they're trying to do, all the figures that they're trying to display, all the tables that they're putting up to supplement the language, which is just not doing the job. Right. and I find that's why your corrective view on language, I'm just going to put it that way for now, that, you know, if you look at the information side, you're looking merely at one side of it, and perhaps not even the primary side of it. And I think that this is, my experience has shown me something that very many early career researchers just miss, that their texts are, they believe that their texts are, you know, solely about the subject matter. They've got to get the subject matter right. And yet the successful texts have an entirely different, well, there's, I mean, everything in your book they have sometimes narratives, they have certainly coordination around key terms and ideas expressed in ways that make sense to the right groups of people, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think, you know, you touched on some really important points. In general, I think that when we use language, it's very natural to feel that to not even see language, you know, the kind of idea that language is like water for fish. You know, the fish are swimming in the water, and they don't know what water is. It's invisible to them in some sense, and language is like that too. So it means that we use language to describe our findings. We use it to, you know, write a report or something. And it's very natural just to not even notice that you're choosing words to describe things. You just tell things the way they are. But in reality, you know, language is this very fragmentary system. So, you know, in the book, I talk about some of the ways in which we have incredibly detailed, very fine perception for things like colors, you know, smells and so on. We have very, very fine a capacity to perceive distinctions in the world, but our languages are very, very coarse and give you only a small number of categories for describing those things. Even so, we feel like when we talk about our experience, we're somehow, you know, adequately capturing it. And the truth is that we really aren't adequately capturing it. What we're doing is relying on the imagination of the person we're talking with to meet us in the same place that we want to go, in some sense, you know, to coordinate around an idea that is sufficiently close to what I want to talk about. So an interesting way of describing that is the way that Daniel Dorr, the communication scholar, calls it. He refers to language as a way of instructing the imagination, that you're not really passing a bit of information across. What you're doing is instructing or inviting the other person to imagine the thing that you are imagining. So it puts a lot more agency in the mind of the other person. And it makes you realize how you have actually less agency over, getting the other person to know exactly what you think. So that's a really important point that people should reflect. You know, writers and speakers need to reflect on how language really doesn't do enough work for us that we did, or at least it doesn't do the amount of work that we think it does. And we tend to be overly confident. So I was reading recently with students of mine here at the University of Sydney, the famous paper by George Orwell on politics in the English language. And most people think of that paper as being a sort of, you know, just an instruction set of principles for how to write clearly. But he has some really powerful insights about the choice of language when you're writing. And his basic point is that we're lazy when we write. We're lazy when we choose language because we see the words, familiar words lying around and we just grab them. And he says that when you do that, you're letting the language think for you. You are allowing these very coarse, very fragmentary ideas that happen to be coded in your particular language. You're just letting them sort of channel your thinking along this very sort of partial lines. And so he actually recommends in that paper that we should get our thoughts straight as far as possible without using language at all. Figure out clearly what we think, and only after we know what we think, then finding the right words. And essentially, it's a recipe for much more mindfulness in thinking about how we speak, and so therefore greater agency, really greater control over the clarity of what we say.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with the essay, and George Orwell is a fantastic writer, and I like this idea of it being mindful thinking that he's talking about, because there is certainly an element of that. But I find the way that you are able to extend his approach is by showing also a lot of the psychological research and other research that shows that there's a limit to how mindful the individual can be. Right. I mean, our concepts and our words are so intertwined to each other that, you know, part of what we really need to do to get back to this idea that you say of instructing the other person's imagination, for instance, from Dore, that we need to recognize that our agency is limited or bigger than we think. It's you talk about distributed agency as being really what's going on when we communicate with others. And again, this brings me back to this idea that when somebody's beginning to write about science, and even people up through their mid-careers and some people throughout their entire careers, they're not noticing that. Their focus is on the subject rather than on the reader. I mean, I think a late career scientist will start to just intuitively get that more, but I don't think very many early career ones will. And that is precisely, I think, what they're missing, this point that you say that their focus on the subject matter, of course, then is to the detriment of a focus on how they might help another person interpret in the way that they're interpreting. So they'll be laying down plain facts in a results section, relying, unfortunately, on the idea that the results speak for themselves, as the saying goes. But, I mean, your view of language and your proof in the book shows that, well, if it's in language, those results are not going to speak for themselves, are they?
No, exactly. So I think this is really important that we need to, I mean, there's one of the most powerful principles of science is self-criticism. You know, it's the classic kind of Popper idea that you want to be as creative as possible, but then you want to apply a very austere kind of self-criticism and try to prove yourself wrong. And so to my mind, that really suggests a kind of a, not just self-critique, but, you know, true kind of critical thinking around whether the categories that you have are the only possible ones, and whether your intuitions about how to talk about something are actually the right ones. So it's quite hard to imagine the things that you don't know, as we all know. And so what are the strategies you might use to kind of break out of the ruts of your language? Well, one of the people that I talk about quite a bit in the book is Benjamin Lee Whorf. the linguistic anthropologist from who worked in the US in the 20th century. And he's famous for developing, along with others, this idea of linguistic relativity, the idea that the language you speak can affect your reasoning and behavior in certain ways. And he makes this really important point that, you know, we are directed in this way and that by our language along the lines we've been discussing. And he says that, you know, there's an antidote to that. And the antidote is learn more languages, learn other ways of talking about reality. And that might literally mean, you know, he meant, you know, learn North American native languages, learn European languages, learn different ways of framing the world. And he said that, you know, this is one way to essentially see colors that you haven't seen before. You know, you can think thoughts you haven't thought before. And I think that's true of languages, but it's also true in science of different, you know, we have this other sense of the word language. You know, chemists talk differently from astronomers, and they talk differently from philosophers, and they talk differently from psychologists. And so that's one of the really important benefits of interdisciplinary work, interdisciplinary reading, interdisciplinary writing, because what you have to do is sort of have to translate, but the important benefit of that is that you're seeing reality in different ways. You're seeing different framings of how things are, and that shakes up your thinking. That allows you to see your own native intuitions as not being just a default kind of perfect representation of reality, but really one framing among many other possible framings. And that's really crucial to mindful writing.
Yeah, I love the, I mean, I view also different disciplines in science as being different cultures from a sort of systemic functional view of what culture means. It doesn't need to necessarily be then, you know, a nation. I mean, a nation and the matchup between a nation and a culture and a language, as we know, is very shoddy indeed. But what you say there about, you know, scientific cultures entirely. And I think that's what one of, I mean, so many of the ideas that your book was inspiring in me was just this idea of, if you can find the majority ways that your culture, so let's say the sub-community of chemists that you happen to work in, frame things. That research community has, you know, their own narratives, their own framings, their own vocabulary, and their own grammar. Then I think it has a double payoff for you. I mean, one, on your own research thinking level, you've enabled yourself to think more, right? Because you can think in, you know, to use the metaphor, outside of the box. So this would be the chemist who, you know, reads into also biochemistry and so on. But it also allows you to socially coordinate when you bring those ideas back into your community, because you know the points at which you can share attention, have common ground with the people actually in your community to bring in these new ideas. So this would be, you know, the section of a paper that is like abstract or introduction where the context is set, and it's there that message needs to come across of, well, what is it actually that you're thinking, and what value does it have for us?
Right. Yeah, I think there's a really important point there about having sort of a foot in two worlds in some sense. And that's where I think innovation really comes from and where it has a real effect. So it's one thing to innovate, but you also need to have uptake. You know, the innovation has to take off and be diffused in the relevant community. So, you know, there's an observation that you know, a revolutionary still has to sing their songs, you know, using traditional folk style, because that's, you know, the content might be new in some sense or preaching revolution, but you have to use a conservative kind of medium in some sense to spread that message. So I think, you know, that's a really important insight that to get across to an audience, you have to have, part of the framing has got to be comprehensible. It's just purely a matter of audience design. But you need to know how much you can innovate or do something a bit different, particularly if you want to attract attention or somehow do something that's a little bit different from the norm. So as you were talking, I was thinking of the observation that many breakthroughs in science, so I'm thinking of, you know, Thomas Kuhn's model of kind of scientific revolutions, often the breakthroughs in science come from outside the discipline. Often they really, you know, the discipline gets stuck into these kind of, dead ends, or maybe not dead ends, but just run out of ideas, partly because, the ways of talking they become very conservative. And it really requires somebody from outside to attack the ideas in a way that they're not, picking up these lazy ways of describing, but they're actually having to innovate and come up with their own way of describing things. And then that attracts people's attention if it has some value. But very often it's that combination of outsider and insider that creates the spark.
This lazy way of writing or even reading. Yeah, I have made the case on this program many times that reading is underestimated in science. I believe that we need a scientific reading just as much as we need a scientific writing. But in any case, this lazy way, this Orwellian view, which has found followers also all the way up to today. I mean, Verlin Klinkenborg, for instance, if you happen to be perhaps familiar with him, has written about the use of language in writing and in similar tones and with similar vocabulary, and also very convincingly. But this is exactly what excites me about your book, because that is true, right? We need to engage with our words and understand, for instance, what level of a category are we taking? Are we saying spoon? Are we saying utensil? Are we saying the spoon we bought 2 years ago at IKEA, right? I mean, so that also translates into science, right? Are you using an abstraction? Are you naming the actual instrument or what have you? I mean, so there's that, but there is just this complicating factor now of no matter how well I do it, I can't actually bring the reality, that brute reality, to bring us back around to the beginning, into the language, because the language is there, evolved, yeah, over many tens of thousands of years to do something actually different. So I'm going to have to recognize in my way of using the language also that I'm meant to coordinate with somebody, that I'm meant to instruct them in thinking and help them interpret and so on and so forth, to use some of the various devices that you talk about, framing, narrating, priming, and all these other things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the important things to think about there is that it related to what we've been discussing. You know, if you have, in a sense, lazy ways of speaking, or of interpreting when you're reading and so on, oftentimes what that means is that you're not considering alternatives. And to not consider alternatives is to, you know, that's where the real problem comes, that you thinking of something in your mind and you want to coordinate around it with someone else. And if you just grab the most immediate way of talking about it, what that means is that, you know, there's a possible opportunity cost. If you describe it in this way, the usual way, then, you know, you're not choosing all the other possible ways you could describe it. And this is one of the magical things about language, is that, as you pointed out, you can take any object or any, you know, action or event, and you can describe it in almost infinite number of ways. You know, it's a pet, it's a dog, it's a mammal, etc. And so we are not really, you know, we don't really have time to negotiate or overthink every single grammatical or lexical choice. You know, we can't always think about our wording every time we write a single word. So that's a way in which, you know, we really can't escape our language a lot of the time. But when you're writing something that really is important, You know, I think that's where mindfulness really matters, is that you are considering the alternative ways of saying it, and really kind of, I think the most healthy thing is pushing yourself away from just gravitating to the default kind of ways of speaking. You have to be strategic, but I think it's always worth remembering that when you pick a word or a phrase, or you write something in a certain way, it's always a choice not to have written it in all these other ways, and that's okay. But it's a choice that you're making, and oftentimes we overlook that fact that we're actually making active choices every time we describe something.
Yeah, indeed. And those choices are being made in dialogue with your community, even if it's an imagined dialogue, but it's going to become real when your text is then actually read, because that unspoken text beside, between, or behind the words that you haven't chosen are going to be activated for enough readers that, you know, it's there anyway. And this is a point that you wonderfully make in various contexts throughout the book. And I want to also tell readers that this is a fantastic book to read. You were mindfully writing this, Nick. So you do give us very many quotable lines that just clarify your point. One on topic right now is, I quote, "One might say that a language predisposes us to think certain things. But perhaps its main effect is in causing us not to think certain things." And this repeats in various contexts with various experimental evidence and from various angles throughout the book. And it is an essential insight, I find.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I really appreciate that. And, you know, it's, as you know, writing clearly is not at all easy. So it's gratifying if the clarity is there. I think, you know, linking that point to something you said just a moment ago, I think it's really important that the choices that we have in language. So, you know, there is a level in which I have choice when I'm speaking English. I can pick, you know, all these words and all these idioms. But as you suggested before, a lot of the choices, I mean, the selection of choices I have is actually not up to me. I can't invent new expressions. I have to work with what I have been given by, you know, the history of the language, by our ancestors and the people who spoke English, you know, 10 years ago and 20 years ago and 100 years ago. So many of the choices have already been made by a historical community that has coordinated around things in the past. And, you know, culture changes. So we're stuck in this very interesting and slightly strange kind of lag between the historical communities that forged our languages and us today who are trying to innovate and work with the languages in a kind of new world. So I think that's really important, that we need to think about that idea you just cited from the quote, that the things where our language is causing us not to think, you know, we're being pushed in the direction of people who lived long ago in the past. And sometimes that doesn't matter, but sometimes, you know, it channels our thinking in certain ways that we're really very seldom aware of.
Yeah, and this is really pertinent to the publication of science, what you're saying there, because you talk about historical communities, the communities that formed English. English now has a new register that has gone entirely international, the language of science. And the quirky sort of contradictory thing about that is, in scientific publishing, language use is quite conservative, actually, in its norms. And yet innovation is very often, or new thinking is very often, at the heart of a particular field. So there again, I notice a tension that has in the past played out over generations in the culture of a language, now being played out over periods of 2 to 3 years, right? Because science is working inside of its publishing industry and in its formats for writing that may not always suit it.
That's right. And I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, the conservative nature of language. So one of the things we've been talking about is things like what words mean, what idioms mean. But another whole area of structure in language is in the various genres that we use. So, you know, scientific writing is not just this one thing. As you well know, it's quite diverse. And when it comes to, for example, when we're writing for journals, some journals are very open to you. You can write, you know, whatever kinds of section organization you want. You can use different sort of tone in the language. Other journals are very strict. We want this section, and then we want that section, and then we want the other section. And you know, they will have very harsh word limits, which will force you to write in a certain way. So different areas of science are going to constrain you in certain ways. And those sets of constraints themselves are really, you know, again, ways of forcing you not to say certain kinds of things or say things in certain kinds of ways. And that sort of conservatism is useful in a way. I understand that particularly that scientists are trying to, you know, often scientific publications are really trying to kind of maintain the idea that science is about reporting facts. It's not about, you know, literary expression. It's about just, you know, we hear the facts, we want to see what they are. We don't want, you know, a novel or anything like that. But I do think that is, you know, it's just not always going to succeed. And oftentimes we need to break out of those kinds of constraints to make progress.
And to bring us full circle to close out our interview, I would like to return to the conclusion and just sort of riff briefly on what you just said there about this idea that science is meant to or wants to have the appearance of just reporting the facts, when your book and some of what we've said shows that there's a lot more going on than just mere reporting. But the industry itself certainly wants to curtail certain types of expression and keep, you know, a common format and a common way of speaking up front. And I think some of the idea behind that is that there's an exchange. There's, as you say in the conclusion, a marketplace for ideas view of communication. But you conclude so eloquently on the idea, well, maybe it is more a marketplace for justifications, isn't it? Because what is actually happening when you enter into contact with new ideas is you're immediately bringing them up against your own. So what's really happening is arguing, replacing, reframing, acting a bit more like a lawyer, to use the sort of role that you give us in the subtitle there, and less like a scientist.
Well, I think that's, you know, to my mind, I think we need to defend the scientist beneath all of that, by which I mean not the professional scientist, but anybody who would defend knowledge of reality. And so, you know, we do need to be mindful of the power of language to influence. And we always are influencing people when we use language. That's foundationally what all communication is. It's influencing other agents. But because brute reality is so important to us, because it's, you know, it's ultimately life and death, we really have a responsibility to convey the truth and not to convey falsehoods, to be clear and not to be vague. So, you know, it's really about understanding the power of those two things, the power of being a scientist and conveying truth, and at the same time, the power of being a lawyer and influencing others, irrespective of the truth. And to my mind, what's so important is that, you know, is that we be good lawyers, but better scientists.
Well, thank you very much for that, Nick. That is Nick Enfield, Professor of Linguistics at the University of Sydney for Language Research and the Sydney Initiative for Truth. His book, Language versus Reality, is out with MIT Press. I'm Daniel Shea. This is goodbye from me to Nick. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
And this is goodbye to all of you. Bye-bye. And until next time here on Scholarly Communication.